Okay, so now we're dealing with ethics, the branch of philosophy that deals with what is right and wrong, or what is good or right. And a lot of different, the right has been defined in many different ways. Thrasymachus, the ancient Greek philosopher, we'll come back to him later because he really shouldn't be listed, even though he was way back there. But it was because of the ancient skeptics who said, like, they're point number six in your notes, there is no right. There's no such thing as right and wrong. The ancient skeptics said that. And Thrasymachus, so moral skepticism, another way of saying moral relativism, no real right and wrong. The ancient skeptics Thrasymachus came on the scene. He said, well, if that's the case, then for all practical purposes, might is right. Okay, so it'd be like if we were the only people, the people in this room, if we were the only ones, maybe the strongest one in this room, could say, hey, look, you're going to do what I say. And they say, well, who made you king? I can kick anybody's butt in here. So the strongest one in the room becomes the leader and decides what is right. Because if there is no, if there really is no such thing as right and wrong metaphysically, then it's all about power. And but then a couple guys can get together and say, well, you know, the two of us can beat up so and so. So now all of a sudden the might shifts because the two guys combined could beat up the one guy. But then maybe the other people go with the first guy. They liked his leadership a little better and his definition of right. So they figure out a way to throw objects. And they're better at throwing objects. So the might can shift what that means, but it's basically he who has the most power wins. It's kind of an ends justifies the means type of thing. Now, the good thing was Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, Greek philosophers like that, that believed in a world of real, invisible moral values, and that there is such a thing as right and wrong, they won the debates. So that's what prevented the might is right from reigning. The next time the skeptics, the moral skeptics, so this is like, I don't know, do I have a date for Thrasymachus there?
No.
Okay. Let's just say about, I don't know, 400 B.C., okay? So he gets defeated, and so skepticism dies out because the best philosophers believe there is such a thing as right and wrong. Well, then they rear their ugly heads again about 300 B.C. I think this kind of, this moral skepticism, once people realize, well, then if there's no such thing as right and wrong, I can force my views on other people. I'm telling you, we got political leaders right now that are exercising Thrasymachus' might is right. But about 350 or let's say 380 B.C., skepticism was again spreading throughout the Roman Empire, and then this one guy came on the scene with tremendous impact and influence and refuted skepticism, and he was a Christian philosopher. Anybody know his name? Augustine, Saint Augustine. So here it was like the Socrates, Plato, Aristotle's that refuted that. Then it's Augustine refutes it, okay? Well, and then the Christian reputation was so powerful that from the 4th century A.D. through the 19th century and on into the 20th century, Western civilization survived. See, to save an individual, you need to trust in Jesus for salvation. But when it comes to the survival of an empire or a country, an empire or a nation, it's going to deal a lot with the way that nation or empire submits to God's moral laws or not. Okay? And so basically now...
You've got 380 B.C.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much.
Really?
380 A.D. You guys were trying to think, why? I don't think there was any... I don't think there was any Christian philosophers in 380 B.C. Yeah, you're right, there wasn't. Okay, so now we come down to... To 2015 right now. And... He died in the year 1900, but his name was Nietzsche. Nietzsche, the way he said might is right. If truth is metaphor, and if God is dead, there's no such thing as truth. If God is dead, truth is dead, morality is dead, meaning is dead. But if morality is dead, then all that's left... We've thrown reason out the window is man's will to power. Okay? I would argue that even though we've had C.S. Lewis, who sounded the warning, Francis Schaeffer, right now Ravi Zacharias is sounding the warning. I'm sounding the warning, but very few people have heard of who I am. But I'm arguing that we did not listen to Lewis or Schaeffer. And so basically... The modern-day Thrasymachus, Nietzsche's will to power, that we're seeing that unfold in our country, let alone in the world. What happens is we find out Planned Parenthood, that's in the business of killing babies before they're born, we now find out they've been selling human body parts. Okay? So what does the Justice Department want to do? They want to investigate those who recorded them to see if it was illegal. So the bad guys are not the ones who kill unborn babies and want to sell their body parts. The bad guys are the ones who revealed that they're selling the body parts because it's all about might is right and the will to power. That's what political correctness
and the question was,
is the unleashing of the will to power.
You also forget Crowley, who took Nietzsche and went, okay, if that's all true, then do with that will officially the whole.
Yeah.
I think we would have listened to the Lewis and Schaeffer if Crowley hadn't gotten into the popular culture there.
Very, very likely. And he's talking about Aleister Crowley, who was very big. He was an occultist, Satanist, who had very, very few people today know who he was. But the people who were influenced by him changed the world. So, yeah, Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page bought his old castle. And Jimmy Page, the lead guitarist for Led Zeppelin, I believe was a witch. And with Aleister Crowley, he influenced Anton LaVey, who founded the Church of Satan. The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, it was how many years ago today Sgt. Pepper taught the band to play? But on the day that they released that, that was the birthday of that exact number of years of Aleister Crowley, who called himself B666. Anton LaVey kind of picked up where he left off because he didn't really believe in a literal Satan, but he believed in Nietzsche's will to power. And so it was like promoting a morality that was opposed to Christian morality on all points. Nietzsche believed that by rejecting the soft values of Christianity and embracing the hard values of the Superman, through his will to power, the Superman would lead us to the next stage. We would increase in human creativity and it would lead to the next stage in human evolution. And so, yeah, and so Aleister Crowley's influence was really big. You get guys like Dr. Timothy Leary, an Ivy League professor, who said that his buddy, I forget what his name was, but he went to India and became Ram Dass, a leading guru in India. And Timothy Leary said, yeah, but it's so hard to take that Jean-Paul Sartrean leap of blind faith in the non-rational realm. My buddy's doing it well through Hindu meditation. I'm going to try it through LSD trips. And then the Beatles fell in love with Timothy Leary, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, code for LSD. And it's really, you know, transiting. You have the Eastern gurus coming in. So I think that Aleister Crowley, I would not say that he alone, and I don't think that's what you're saying, Blake, but I don't think he alone offset this. But he was one of the pillars that I would say in Eastern thought, the whole drug culture, the hedonism of the 1960s, the hippie counterculture movement, that he was very instrumental in that. Also, you could see, if you read the works of Nick Redfern, who's not a Christian, as far as I know, Aleister Crowley, and Jack Parsons of NASA had a very big influence on the modern UFO movement. In fact, Nick Redfern seems to imply that they were the ones who opened the door to the modern UFO movement. And that, I think, is very demonic. But basically what I'm getting at is political correctness. You are not shouted down and eventually going to prison because your views are wrong or false. You're going to prison because you're not politically correct. That's might is right and man's will to power. And now the thing is, under Hitler, even though he was a neo-pagan, he was also a Darwinist. What we saw there was Darwin's survival of the fittest. And that is much more tame than Nietzsche's will to power. Survival of the fittest, the strong weed out the weak in order to survive. Okay? And the will to power, the strong dominate the weak just because you can. Okay? And it's not something you have to do. It's something you will to do. Okay? And it's not Joseph Mengele experimenting on innocent human beings to try to further the survival of the fittest, which he thought was the Aryan race. It's Planned Parenthood selling human body parts just because they can and there's more money to be made. Okay? So those are the ugly times in which we live. Some would say morals are mores. Just each community decides, but then one community can't condemn the actions of another community as wrong. Protagoras said man is the measure, but if each person decides, then one person can't condemn the actions of another person, like Adolf Hitler. We can't condemn that as wrong. Some would say the human race is right, but the world is often wrong. You know, slavery, woman treated as property at one point. And then, you know, even more relativists try to make the world a better place to live. They're trying to change the world consensus there. The Epicureans believe right is what brings pleasure. They have to keep in mind Epicurus, a philosopher who lived before Jesus, if he walked into this classroom, he would say, I can't believe it. Epicureans, thousands of years after I lived. Because for him, the right is whatever brings the most pleasure. But as a philosopher, he thought what brings the most pleasure is intellectual pursuits. So talking philosophy all day, what most people would describe as hell on earth, for him, that was the highest level. Well, eventually his disciples said, no, whatever brings the most physical pleasure is right. And so it was hedonism. And you know, not all pain is bad. Surgery can often be good. And not all pleasure is good. Some people derive pleasure by inflicting harm. They derive sexual pleasure from inflicting harm on other people. Then the utilitarianism, which says the right is the greatest good for the human race, the greatest good for the greatest number. So they're saying there's no such thing really as good and evil except for the greatest good for the greatest number. Okay? So now they're defining the good with the word good in their definition. Okay? So right there you realize, okay, we got a Houston, we have a problem here. But it's the greatest good for the greatest number. But if they don't believe in right and wrong and in good and evil, then what in the world does good mean? And why would you think the greatest good for the greatest number is the good? If there's no such thing as good and evil, why not just blow up the whole human race? And maybe that's the good. But the good is totally left undefined. And so you know what this turns into? B.F. Skinner wanted him. He believed we were biologically controlled, genetically controlled, and then controlled by our environment. Man is not free. He wrote the book Beyond Freedom and Human Dignity. He said, therefore, me and my buddies, he was a utilitarian, we need to decide what the greatest good for the greatest number is, and then take away human freedom and help the world to achieve the best possible future. Problem is, you just argued there is no such thing as good and evil. So, and then you and your buddies are controlled by their genes. They're biologically controlled, their decisions, and they're controlled by their environment, so they're not even free. So what makes you think you know what the greatest good for the greatest number is when you don't even have a basis? There's no such thing as good, and you guys are just as controlled as the others. So what does the greatest good for the greatest number become? Might is right again. It's Nietzsche's will to power. And this is what we're seeing today. You know, the United Nations over there, they're just waiting for the day when they get to call all the shots. They've decided a long time ago we have way too many human beings on this planet. Yeah. And instead of encouraging capitalism is viewed as evil by the UN, it seems like by this present Pope as well. But capitalism, free enterprise, increases productivity. Okay? It encourages people to produce. If you aren't a productive member of society, you're going to starve to death in a really free society. So you need to try to work hard and create products and hire people, create jobs. Okay? Socialism, which is what the UN is all for, discourages productivity. It takes from the producers and gives to the non-producers, which encourages everybody to be non-productive. So they create the problem, and then they come on the scene and say, we've got the solution. Let me tell you, if you created the problem, you probably don't have the solution. When liberal politicians created the problem by disarming people in the inner cities through gun control, and you created the problem, so now the thugs are not afraid of anybody, don't go to the liberals for the solutions. There's going to be more gun control, more government programs that causes more dependency on welfare. And so socialism is anti-productivity. The reason why people starve is we're not, the resources are there. We're just not producing the resources. So the solution is we need to be more productive. With these guys, because they like socialism, productivity is not the answer. What they say is we need to lessen the number of human beings on the planet Earth. And so the the idea of the greatest good for the greatest number, they end up slaughtering, wanting to slaughter billions of people. And it comes right back to might is right and will to power. This is why it's so important that we stand up for objective morality. Now, the Christian view here is good is what God wills. However, the essentialist, so Blake and I would agree on that, good is what God wills. But the essentialist, most traditional Christian thinkers throughout history have said, however, God only wills that which is consistent with his good nature. Okay? But it flows from God's nature through his will, and that's where we get what is right and what is wrong. Now, the Christian view of right and wrong, God's moral laws are revealed in nature, in our conscience, Romans 2, 14 and 15. Even the Gentile, even the pagan who does not have God's moral laws written in the Bible, still has God's moral laws written in his heart, his conscience bearing witness. Okay? But then God has his moral laws also revealed in Scripture. By the way, the Founding Fathers mentioned both in the Declaration of Independence. The laws of nature and of nature's God. Okay? Blackstone's commentaries, which is what where the Founding Fathers got their terms from, it was kind of a legal dictionary. The laws of nature were God's laws written on our hearts, our moral consciences. The laws of nature's God are God's laws written in the Bible. So the Founding Fathers were saying was we're building, even though some of them weren't Christians, some of them were deists, they all agreed that you need to build, if you want a free society, it's got to be built on God's laws written on our hearts and God's laws written in the Bible. In other words, they accepted the biblical view of government and morality. And that's why we've experienced so much freedom here. And so God revealed through nature in our consciences his moral laws, but also revealed in scriptures. When we say God's absolute moral laws, we mean things that are right for all people at all times and in all places. So man does not create absolute moral laws. Man discovers God's absolute moral laws. Just like we don't create the laws of logic, we discover them. Okay, move right on to the next section. How do we know what is right? The pragmatist, The pragmatist would say whatever works is right. Now let me say something. There's sometimes we Christians are too hard on pragmatism because it is right to trust in Jesus for salvation. It is right to submit to God's word and obey it through the power of the Holy Spirit. And guess what? That's the only thing that works in the long run. So there is a pragmatic aspect to moral absolutes in that if you get with God's program, it does work. The problem is we humans don't respect the Bible. And we often don't look at, we often think of pragmatism as what works today or what will work for tomorrow, when in reality, if it doesn't work for eternity, it should be rejected. But pragmatism is just justified, actions are justified by the results. William James, something is right if it works. So you got pragmatism. Is it?
Right.
Actually, I think it's actually just pragmatism. Pragmatism.
Never admitted to being a
community
word. This is always be pragmatism.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's the way pragmatism.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it means being pragmatic. But whatever.
Pragmatic,
Is it? See, I've got it spelled there, but the thing is, it's not. It's pragmatism. It's not pragmatism. It's pragmatism.
True word,
pragmatism.
Yeah. I think
pragmatism is usually used in epistemological context.
So that is the proper spelling, though.
Yes.
Okay. So well, you just don't pronounce.
Actually,
see, I always, and the thing is, too, is it's always pronounced pragmatism. So it doesn't look like the way it's spelled.
We're lazy.
But whatever the case, it's whatever works is right. In the area of epistemology, whatever works is true. Okay? But, you know, the problem with that, of course, is sometimes lies work. Cheating on exam, it might work. You might become a lawyer, pass the bar exam, but that didn't mean it was the right thing to do. Aquinas justified what is right and what is wrong. By self-evidence. In other words, he would say it's self-evidently true. This is right from Romans 2:14 and 15. God's law is written on our hearts. It's self-evidently true that murdering innocent people is wrong. Okay, things of that sort. So now, keep in mind, Aquinas would view this differently than somebody like Augustine. Augustine might say it's self-evidently true because God created us with this knowledge, which I think is a better interpretation of Romans 2:14 and 15. Aquinas would say, no, we start life as a blank slate, but the active mind, the active intellect, has the ability to see that moral laws are self-evidently true once we have sense experiences. So just because he believes they're self-evident doesn't mean he believes they're innate. Okay? Something's got to kind of trigger us to have that knowledge. Thomas Hobbes, justification by appeal to human authority, the king declares what is right. Again, you get right back to might is right. Thrasymachus's might is right. Okay, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and many other religions, justification by appeal to divine authority. Now, Aquinas is going to agree with this, but he still thinks they're also self-evidently true. It's like J.P. Moreland said, I may not be able to prove it, but I know with no doubt whatsoever that torturing innocent babies is evil. Okay? And but the Christians could be voluntarist, where God arbitrarily determined the good by his will alone, or essentialism, the good is based ultimately on God's nature. And you know, you have that debate within Christian circles. Okay, turn the page. The relationship between rules and results. We're actually doing pretty good here. I'm really going to skim over the last few of these, but the relationship between rules and results, there's deontological ethics. And there's teleological. Now remember, teleological, the design argument, that things were intelligently designed and that's evidence for God. They show a purpose, a goal of the things that are created. So the deontological ethics say that the rules determine what is right. Rules determine the right. Teleological, it's the end or the goals, the results determine what is right. Okay. And so which do you think the Christians, the most Christians fall into? What camp are Christian thinkers?
Should fall into, now I can't say it, the rule of the term of the right.
Mm-hmm. Deontological. Whether you're a voluntarist who said, well, God arbitrarily willed the good, or an essentialist who said God's will is only subject to his good nature, so God had to will that which is good, either way, God's will determines what is right. And so when the Christians say, well, how do you know that's right? Because it's God's will. That's not a nonsensical statement. Now, you need to be able to back it up with a lot of philosophical thought, but in the end, if God is God, if he is the all-good, all-powerful, eternal God, then yeah, whatever he wills is good. Okay? The question would still come up, is his will based on his good nature? Or does his will just arbitrarily determine, again, the voluntarist, essentialist debate? But both sides are going to agree, rules determine what is right, not the results. Now, the right use of results, though, results of our actions should not be ignored. Results can help us determine which ethical rule applies. So God determines what is right, but our circumstances may help us discover which of God's rules should apply. Like, for instance, Rahab the harlot. You know, should she submit to the Canaanite governing authorities? Should she tell them the truth? Or should she lie to save the lives of innocent Jewish spies? And God commends her throughout for telling a lie and protecting their lives. Results don't make an act right, but they often manifest what is right. So I have Matthew 7:20. Listed here, Matthew 7:20. Jesus says, so you will know them by their fruits. A good tree bears good fruit, a bad tree bears bad fruit. So the results don't make an action right, but they often manifest what is right. In the long run, right action in the long run will bring about good results. You know, you might say, that guy's got a lot of charisma, really good preacher. Well, if he's preaching heresy, if the fruit of his teachings are heretical, the results of his preaching, then you don't go there, or if his lifestyle. Still, good results are no guarantee that the action was right. I'll say this, though, too. Let's say you've got to make a choice, and it's not really a moral choice. It's a choice where you just don't know God's will, and you say, well, I could preach the gospel in Washington State, or I could move back to New Jersey and preach the gospel. You need to sit down and look at, you know, maybe there's a pragmatic side here, a teleological side, where maybe the results could help you discover what would be the best decision. But that's an area where it's kind of both choices, you can make a case, are morally right. And so this gets beyond morality, and you might just say, what will have the best results for God's kingdom? You might say, I could go door to door, I could do street evangelism, or I could try to do street evangelism to hundreds of people coming off the ferry. I can go door to door to hundreds of people and hand out tracts, or I can try to build relationships with people at Starbucks and try to lead them to Christ and disciple them. I would argue you're more likely to get good results by building relationships with people, at least in our day and age.
Well, that's more teleological wisdom than ethics. I mean, I remember Martin Luther had said, first obey God and keep his commandments, love God, then do as you please.
Yeah.
I mean, when it comes to things that are not an ethical situation, I mean, we have the Book of Proverbs, we have not chronology, we have an actual term for practical wisdom that we can use.
And what I'm saying too, though, is even in the realm of morality, results might be something you might want to think about. Because you might even say, okay, my child did wrong, I have to discipline them. What type of discipline am I going to use if you know for sure that grounding them doesn't work or spanking them doesn't work? You know, so in other words, there could be a pragmatic side that may come into play if everything else is equal. But for the most part, it's the rules that are going to determine what is right, not the results. Pure teleological ethics says the ends justifies the means. And we've got to stay away from that. So, we just got to look at, is the right universal, and do moral duties ever conflict? And we'll probably just need about 35, 40 minutes for that. So let's take a 5-minute break. I know I need a break right now, and so I'll be back in a little. Okay, so is the right universal? And so here we come back to moral relativism. And that says there are no moral absolutes. You know, it's right for you, it's right for you, it doesn't have to be right for me, and vice versa. It's the most simplistic form of it. Moral absolutism there are moral absolutes, and by that I mean moral laws that apply to all people at all times in all places. Okay? And the Bible obviously teaches the latter. We don't have time to go through all the different types of moral relativism. But Friedrich Nietzsche probably said it best. He said, God is dead. Atheism destroyed belief in God. Therefore, all objective values have died with him. So we need to go beyond good and evil. Nietzsche rejected the soft values of Christianity, such as forgiveness, mercy, grace. And he recommended the hard values and the will to power of the Superman. And that's going to, believe me, the Nazis were a failed wimpy attempt at the Superman, the Overman. What we're going to see, you know, hundreds of millions of people, well, somewhere between 170 million and 320 million people were killed by their own governments during peacetime in the 20th century, not even counting the wars. And by the way, that's more people than have died in all of mankind's wars together. So big government is much more of an efficient killer than war is. War, at least both sides are armed. But the 21st century, we're going to see Nietzsche's will to power unleashed, and it's probably going to lead to the death of billions, not millions. And so we as Christians believe the right is universal. We would argue that we all appeal to universal moral law when we make moral judgments, especially when we're wrong. Remember, Jesus said, treat others the way you want to be treated. He didn't say, treat others the way you know they should be treated. Because then what we would say as fallen humans, we'd say, well, obviously I'm special. I've been special since the time I was born. I mean, my parents could see it in me. They loved me more than other children. And so I'm supposed to be the king of the world. And so if I treat others the way I know they should be treated, I'm going to enslave them. But Jesus said, no, treat others the way you want them to treat you. See, we are so corrupt, we only recognize evil when we're the victim. When we're the victimizer, we can come up with lots of reasons why I did. Oh, the guy was looking at me funny, you know. That's why I hit him. But we all recognize evil when we're wronged. And if morality is relative, if the moral law comes from each individual, then we can't condemn another individual like Adolf Hitler as wrong, his actions as wrong. Now, we covered this already in the moral argument for God, so it just should be review right now. If morality comes from each society, that's the next step up, then one society cannot condemn the actions of another society, like Nazi Germany or the Taliban or ISIS, as wrong. But even more relativists want to condemn their actions. So then they might say, well, maybe world consensus. Well, world consensus has often been wrong, but even moral relativists want to change the world consensus and make the world a better place to live. So they're when the atheist tries to make the world a better place to live, or the moral relativist tries to make the world a better place to live, they're appealing to a moral standard above all individuals, above all societies, and above any world consensus. They're saying, hey, even the world consensus is wrong. So they're appealing to a moral standard above it. And it's a moral law qualitatively above all men and applicable to all men. It's not just quantitatively adding humans. So if we fight for world progress, we condemn the actions of the past, we try to build a better future, we're implying that the absolute moral law, which is above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus, we're implying that that moral standard is eternal and unchanging. And then you can go from there, showing that, well, then this argues for an eternal and unchanging absolute moral lawgiver who exists above all individuals, all societies, and any world consensus. And remember, the moral law is prescriptive. It prescribes the way things ought to be. It's not descriptive. It just doesn't describe the way things are. Okay? So you need a prescriber for a prescriptive law.
Now, what I would agree with you that this argues for a moral absolute lawgiver. That if you have any moral law out there by government, is legislated. So absolute, unchanging moral laws exist independently of mankind's abilities or opinions, must be legislated by God. How do they answer that? I mean, is there an assumption, well, it's right because it's right, that they're already
in a circle? It's really weird, and I would say this. In a debate, I have incredible difficulty showing the futility of atheistic and moral relativistic thought. But with a brilliant atheist that I'm going to have for an entire semester, it is amazing how powerful the Christian worldview is, because then you have time. You pin them down. They can't go. It's not like, you know what, I got 5 minutes left in this statement, and I'm going to give a baloney answer, and my opponent's going to know it's baloney, but he doesn't have any time left to call me out on it, but I'll still sound like I'm smart, and maybe I'll win this debate. Well, in a full semester when I had my student from Sweden, Alvin, brilliant guy, I got him to admit that the cruel acts of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis were not wrong for all people at all times and all places. He acknowledged that he didn't like them, and he thinks we should legislate against anybody who wants to have that kind of a view, but he acknowledged in writing on the board that it was not wrong for all people all the time. There's no way to condemn it, because if atheism is true, and he believed in atheism. I would love someday to be able to dialogue with an atheist, maybe over the couple hour, 2 hours a night, for an entire week. Now keep in mind, don't send that out as a challenge, because there are a lot of atheists who I would not want. There's a guy, Jersey Flight or something out of Seattle, that he threatens me in his emails trying to get me to debate. and attacks me and makes fun of me. Well, if he's going to do that in a personal email, if I do take a debate with him at University of Washington, what is he going to do in public? Yeah. And what if he pushes my buttons? I don't know how big he does. Well, I might be tempted to do something crazy. And if he blows his top, it doesn't hurt atheism. If I blow my top, it could hurt the cause of Christianity in our area. So, but I would like someday to be able to have, with a courteous atheist, to have prolonged discussions. And, good. Well, maybe. Was that? Yeah. And there's a guy I'm thinking, Jeffrey J. Lauder, a real good friend of mine, and a leading atheist thinker, founded the world's largest atheist website, Internet Infidels, and he lives out there in somewhere like Bellevue or something. But maybe we could do it a series of. We'd want to hold it in a church. We'd want to hold it in a more secular environment where there's non-believers attracted. You hold it in a church, only Christians are going to show up for the most part. And but deal with issues like, you know, does God exist, the problem of evil, but deal with it. Is morality universal or relative? To where you people, what you really believe about it has to come out. Because once people really say what they really believe, some worldviews don't sound as strong as they did before that point. So universal moral laws are anchored in the unchanging character of God. That would be the essentialist position. However, differing situations do help us discover which of God's absolute laws apply. Now here's, this final lecture is going to be what we do when God's moral laws conflict. And I'm going to give you the three responses, and then I'm going to give you my view, which I need to write an article on it because I've been talking about it for years, but I think I'm the only one who holds this view, at least that I know of. But do moral duties ever conflict? There's the third alternative view, more widely known as unqualified absolutism. Okay, and this says there's always a third alternative. There's always a moral way out of every ethical dilemma. There's always at least one good alternative. So you would never, you're never supposed to lie to save a life. You're never to sin to avoid sinning. That's the way they would view it. You trust God to deliver you. And real dilemmas are due to prior sin on your part. So this view would say you might be in a situation where you have to choose a lesser of two evils, and it would still be a sin, but that's only because you sinned before time that led you into that. But God will never place you in a situation where you have to disobey one moral of His moral commands or the other. The Amish would be something like this, where they would never fight to defend someone. Okay, some would go so far to say that if a guy broke into your house and was killing your loved ones, you should never physically fight him. Even defending yourself is wrong. You need to just trust God. And the Bible commends those who deceived others to save human lives. Rahab the harlot. She lies and she doesn't submit to the governing authorities, the Canaanite governing authorities, to save the lives of innocent Jewish spies. You have the midwives in Egypt who were lying to Pharaoh, saying that the Hebrew woman or strong woman, they were giving birth before they got there because they were supposed to kill the babies. Okay. So whatever the case, when we leave the lights on in our home, when we're not home, were doing that to deceive criminals. Any would-be burglar, we're hoping that he'll see the lights on. Maybe we'll leave the television set on. We're deceiving them. Does God say, hey, hey, you're sinning right there? Ronald Reagan, I remember he came out of a meeting, and our patriotic media said, Mr. President, is it true that you've dispatched fighter planes to Libya to bomb Libya Muammar Gaddafi? And Ronald Reagan was waving at him. He said, if that's what we're doing, I have no knowledge of it. And he laughed, and they laughed. And he knew very well he was lying through his teeth. As he was speaking, we were dropping bombs on Tripoli. Okay? When a boxer is boxing another boxer and goes like this and faints, so he's pretending he's going to throw a left, and then based on how the boxer responds, he might end up throwing a right. In all kinds of combat, there's going to be that element of deception. When you have just the fact that the Jewish spies were sent, they were deceiving people and pretending not to be Israelites, spying out the land. So it seems that God's word commends people who sometimes deceived others to save lives. You're allowed in the scriptures to kill in self-defense. There could be a just war. Like when the Amish would say, there's never a just war. No such thing as a just war. And, but sometimes the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And you're allowed to kill somebody if they break into your home at night. But when the sun rises, you can't go out in town, find the guy and shoot him. You know, then you got to turn it over to the governing authorities. So it doesn't okay vigilantism, but it does okay killing in self-defense. There are just wars that God had the Jews involved with. So I think that the unqualified absolutism fails. And so some would say the lesser evil view, also known as conflicting absolutism, we'll call it the lesser evil, that when two of God's moral commands come in conflict, so you can't obey both, you obey the greater command and you disobey the lesser one, and then you ask God for forgiveness because you sinned by committing the lesser one. Okay? But the fact of the matter is, even Jesus faced more moral dilemmas, yet he was without sin. Hebrews 4:15 tells us he was without sin. But he faced moral dilemmas where, you know, the authorities of his day said you can't do any work on the Sabbath day. Sure, they were adding to the Sabbath law. But Jesus would heal on the Sabbath. But he would bring up examples and say, well, if your ox falls into a pit on the Sabbath day, you know, you can go bankrupt. You could starve to death if your farming animal falls into a ditch, goes on the Sabbath day, you're allowed to bring him out. But he says, what about the Jewish leaders when the eighth day falls on the Sabbath and you're supposed to circumcise them? You circumcise them, recognizing circumcision as a higher law because it introduces you to the whole law, which includes the Sabbath law. And so Jesus seemed to indicate, you know, even David and his warriors, when they ate the consecrated bread to stay alive. And so Jesus seems to be saying here, there are times in this cursed creation where you can't obey two of God's commands, and you're going to have to figure out which is the higher one and obey that. But what I don't see for the lesser evil, nowhere does the Bible say that Rahab needed to ask God's forgiveness for lying. In fact, I think if she didn't lie, she would have had to ask God's forgiveness because the blood of two innocent spies would have been on her hands. So then the other position, this is Norman Geisler's position and St. Augustine's position. Norman Geisler's getting up in years, so I think Augustine got it from him. No, I'm only kidding. But the greater good view, also called graded absolutism, and I put it down as the true view because that's what I held to when I made these notes, and it's the view that Geisler and Feinberg hold to. During moral dilemmas, we should obey the greater good, the higher law, and then we receive an exemption in regards to the lower law. So there's no exceptions to absolute laws. They still apply to all people, all times, and all places, but you receive an exemption from it. So the lower laws are overruled by the higher laws. Let me tell you the problem I have with that. And by the way, biblical principles can help us to decide which laws are higher than others. You know, God comes before other people. One's family comes before others. You know, Paul said that if you can't take care of your own household, you got no business trying to be a pastor and trying to take care of the household of God. And persons come before things, you know. So there's a hierarchy there. God comes before government. So if you got to choose between obeying the government and obeying God, with the apostles you say we must obey God rather than men. Acts 5:29. So you've got the apostles and not submitting to the governing authorities. Even Peter and Paul were executed, as were most of the apostles. You got Jesus healing on the Sabbath. You got the Hebrew midwives in Egypt. You got Rahab the harlot. So you got many biblical examples of obeying the greater command and not being held accountable to obeying the lesser command. Here's the only problem I see with the greater good view, okay? A moral law, an absolute moral law, applies to all people at all times in all places. So obviously, not eating pork, that was a command that was only for particular people at a particular time. Okay? But thou shalt not murder. Does that apply to all people at all times in all places? Here's my view. Because with the greater good, you receive an exemption, but it's not an exception. Yeah, but it didn't apply. Thou shalt not bear false witness didn't apply to all people at all times and all places then. So was it really a moral absolute? Now, what I'm going to say is kind of scary, and you need to be careful with how you say this, okay? But my view is what I call unqualified, like the Amish, okay? Unqualified, minimal absolutism. What I'm saying is there is no exemption or exception of a true moral absolute. At the same time, we as Christians believe in moral absolutes, plural, but nobody knows exactly how many there are. I'm saying there's a lot less than we think. But I don't want to shout this from the rooftop, because we should teach. There's a lot of very general commands that are probably not universal or absolute, but we ought to teach them as universal or absolute, because the exceptions to them are so few. So you teach your children not to lie, but you're proud of them if they lie to save the life of another child. Okay? And just common sense tells you, okay, I need to tell a lie here. But whatever the case, we know the two. Anybody know what the two mega moral absolutes are? The two mega.
What?
No, but it would flow from them real quick.
I would say love God.
Okay, love God with everything you got. And then love neighbor as yourself. Those are the two mega absolutes. And then there's several other absolutes that flow from that. For instance, in the Ten Commandments, I don't see any exception whatsoever for thou shalt not commit adultery. However, thou shalt not bear false witness. There are times when God commends people for bearing false witness. So even the Ten Commandments, might not be all absolutes. Do we set apart the Sabbath anymore? Because Sunday is not the Sabbath. Sabbath means Saturday. We believe Jesus is our Sabbath rest, so we're no longer under that. So even the Sabbath law there wasn't an absolute. But if you look at the Ten Commandments, okay, the first four give us examples of what it means to love God. The last six give us examples of what it means to love our neighbor. So in other words, a lot of the moral commands in the Bible might or might not be moral absolutes, universal commands. They might be very general commands that where God is just telling us, hey, usually when you're being a good neighbor, you're submitting to the governing authorities. But there comes a time when you got to say we must obey God rather than men. So it's kind of like these are the two mega absolutes. Jesus said the whole law is based on these. Love God with everything you got. Love your neighbor as yourself. And from that flows like thou shalt not commit adultery. Well, that thou shalt not kill. If it's thou shalt not kill, you can kill in self-defense. You can kill to defend your nation. But some would translate it thou shalt not murder. And that would be any unauthorized killing of a human being. Okay? And but whatever the case, so that's what I go for is unqualified minimal absolutism. It's the greater good view, only it recognizes when you obey the greater command and you get an exemption from the lesser command, then it wasn't a moral absolute anyway. Okay? So just letting you know.
So your view is that when you've got these questions, you're going back to the two mega ones.
Yeah. And thou shalt not covet, I don't think there's never a time that we should covet somebody else's goods or property or spouse or whatever. But there are, so, you know, when you see in the Bible what we thought was a moral absolute and somebody violating it and God saying, that's okay. You know, wives, submit to your husbands. Is that a moral absolute? Not if you married, a guy who just, you know, went insane and tells you to go kill your next door neighbor because he's playing the music too loud. Or if your husband, the husband tells the wife, I don't want you ever going to church. And then he goes off to sea for 3 months. He's in the Navy and you sneak to church. Is God upset with you there? You weren't submitting to your husband. Those are tough choices, but my view, what it retains is the moral absolutes are really absolutes. If it's an absolute, it applies to all people, all times, and all places. At the same time, it acknowledges that when two of God's commands come into conflict, you obey the greater one and not the lesser one, but that just means the lesser one was not fully an absolute. It was just a very general command. So in other words, whenever Jesus says, thou shalt do this, and thou shalt do that, and thou shalt not do this, and not do that, whenever God's word says that, it's just unfolding loving God with your whole being and loving your neighbor as yourself. And some of the things that unfold from that, some of the commands are universal absolute commands, but some of them, there are times when it's God's will for you to disobey that command because it's not an absolute, and if you to obey greatly. Now, where this can be abused is where people just turn it into, my government's using some of taxpayers' money to kill babies so I can cheat on my income taxes. Where you just kind of stack the deck in your favor time and time and time again. But I tell you, we're going to have to make decisions like this more and more. The more corrupt our government becomes.
Right. Coming to a realization, I'm not sure what you mean by unqualified.
Unqualified means if it's a moral absolute, you have to obey it at all times, all people in all places. These guys are taking some, it's like a moral absolute is an absolute moral law applies to all people at all times in all places, but some of them, you find out, don't apply to all people, all times, and all places.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is, well, then that wasn't an moral absolute.
I can qualify what a lie is, because there could be a case where a lie is okay.
No,
unqualified.
Yes.
People say, well, because it's not an absolute, let's just go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Some commands are so general that we should treat them as absolutes, but the unqualified is talking about the absolutes.
Yeah.
If it is an absolute, you have to always obey it. There's no qualification there.
Got it.
But by minimal, what I'm saying is there's a whole lot of things we consider moral absolutes. You know, God says, thou shalt not kill. And a guy busts in your house and is coming at your wife with a knife, and you got a loaded pistol in your hand, God would say, okay, that's not an absolute there. Take him out. And
I think what Blake here just said a few minutes ago, this doesn't give us a license. What we're really talking about is when you're in this moral dilemma, if you will, and this is where this might come in. In other words, my day-to-day life, I am not usually in a moral dilemma.
And there would be people that see any of these views and they try to find a loophole. Like, if you deliver yourself in a situation in which moral duty conflict,
yeah.
You had a bad mindset to begin with.
You could
excuse yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's these, you know, yeah, you could be some people that Hitler and Stalin are running against each other for the presidency. I mean, you know, we're not really far from producing a situation like that to where, you know, and but whatever the case, now some would say I wouldn't vote for either of them, and I think I would agree with that statement, but. What we're saying is finding God's will and obeying it is not always as easy as it sounds. Okay? Sometimes, you know, God called me to get a college education. I'm a student from South Korea. God called me to get an education in America. And God called me to really get a good profession to help my family back in South Korea. And then somebody murders my dad. And now my brother's become an alcoholic and my mother suffers from severe depression. And the guy that murdered my dad was his right-hand man at the business he owned. So now not only is he gone, but the right-hand man's gone. My mother's supposed to run the business and she can't anymore. And so what my former student did was she realized I have to give up on my dream. And I need to go back home and take care of mom and maybe go to college. And you know, so finding God's will and obeying it is not as easy as we make it out to be. You know, there's guys that are walking around saying, God said it, I believe it, it's good enough for me, I'm just going to obey with God. But the world is messed up.
Yeah.
The world is really, really messed up. And sometimes we got to decide, in the Marine Corps, this guy had big fists and everything, and he wasn't even a Christian. But when he was on Liberty, he was at a gas station and in a parking lot behind a truck. He saw this big dude. In fact, it was in the flatbed of the truck. The husband was beating up his wife. And so he just walked real, jumped in there, grabbed the guy and just beat the snot out of him. And I wasn't a Christian, but even I knew that was the right thing to do. And, you know, this guy had big hands, and God gave him big hands for a reason. And nicest guy on the planet,
yeah.
But he wasn't going to stand by while a woman was being beaten by a man. And so, you know, thou shalt not beat up people. That's not an absolute moral command, because when there's a bully beating up on a defenseless person, if you have the ability, if God's gifted you in that area, you might have to use your gifts for God's glory and beat up a bully. And sad thing is, in America, you'll get in trouble. No matter how ruthless the guy was, because our government now is playing God, they alone. You know, we've got some people who think that only the government has the right to bear arms.
Government would say you
Yeah. And she would just sustain maybe only 100 more concussion causes.